Gordon Griffin.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the host and the guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now on the John Frederick Show, Corey Lewandowski. Corey, Happy New Year. Haven't talked to you in a while. Great to have you with us, man.
Happy New Year, John. Great to be back with you.
All right. And my best to you and your family, your wife, Allison, the kiddos. And, well, Corey, let's just start with your Senate race. I was really excited about getting a new studio in New Hampshire. I was going to go right there in your guest house and broadcast every day, and I was really looking forward to Allison's cooking. So from that standpoint, I was a little disappointed in it because I can't get up there now to the extent I had hoped, although I'll be there for the primary. Walk us through your decision, Corey, not to run.
You know, John, I looked at it, and look, it's a very winnable race. I think I could have won the race.
Yep.
But I looked at a couple factors. Number one, what is the most important thing to my family right now? And I've been very clear about it. You know, my daughter, really 13 years old, really didn't want to go through a campaign knowing how brutal some of those things that are said are during a campaign. So that was a factor. But the other factor was, and I spoke to the president about it, I have to put all of my efforts into making sure that Donald Trump and Mike Pence are reelected president and vice president of the United States, because while being a U.S. senator is a phenomenal honor and a huge privilege, if I would have had the opportunity to do that, I wouldn't want to do that if Donald Trump and Mike Pence weren't reelected. So for me, it was a two-factor decision. One was my family, obviously, and my wife was on board, and my boys, who are a little bit younger, you know, they didn't really care so much, to be honest with you. But then the decision of the president and making sure that all of my efforts are involved in making sure that he gets reelected, that we deliver the state of New Hampshire for him, and we grow his success at the electoral level from the Electoral College. That's my priority, and that's why I decided not to run.
All right. Well, look, Corey, many of us are disappointed because we knew if you did run, we know how tough you are. We knew you were going to win that race and beat Gene Shaheen, but I respect your decision. It's yours. You had to make it. And I know you take your family very seriously and have to take everything into consideration. So having said that, let's get to impeachment, the trial. You know the results yesterday. Ends at 2 a.m. No Republicans surprisingly bailed on the trial rules. They got 53 votes. So as it stands now, there's no witnesses being called. No Mulvaney, no John Bolton. That also means no Joe and Hunter Biden. What did you make of yesterday and going forward? What do you see? Corey Lewandowski.
Well, look, I thought Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, did a phenomenal job yesterday outlining the case to the American people and saying that basically it's a sham, it's a witch hunt, and this whole thing should be dismissed. I thought it was very important, and he was very articulate. But the other part, John, which you know, I'm a little surprised at, was the unity of the Republicans here.
Right.
On multiple occasions, they had the opportunity to break with the Republican Party, whether that would have been a Mitt Romney, a Susan Collins, you know, none of them did. And I think the reason for that is twofold. Number one, the American people know that this whole impeachment is a total sham. Number two, these individuals know that by voting against the Republicans, and I'm talking about Susan Collins, I'm talking about Mitt Romney, potentially voting against that, the narrative in Washington, D.C. becomes that this is now a bipartisan impeachment. And what nobody wants to talk about is that when the impeachment vote actually transpired in the House, it was bipartisan against impeachment, because Democrats were voting against this impeachment. And so, you know, keeping the media in check is a big portion of the narrative that's going forward. And we saw Adam Schiff up there mischaracterizing all kinds of different things.
Right.
And there is no compelling evidence to remove the President of the United States with less than 300 days to go before an election, and there is not one person in this country who thinks that there are 20 Republicans who are going to join the Democrats to remove Donald Trump. So this is all just political theater.
Right. I mean, look, everybody knows he's going to get acquitted, so there's going to be no trial. Although Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski did hold out the possibility that they might want to call witnesses later, but just it didn't make any sense to me. I mean, if you didn't vote for extending it and having witnesses now in the pretrial rules, why then in the middle of the trial, with the evidence, you already know what it is because it's already out there, are you suddenly going to change your mind? I mean, I just thought that was a ruse. So what do you think here? 2 weeks, we're out?
Look, I hope so. Look, I hope that the U.S. Senate puts this to bed very quickly and they can get back to doing the work of the American people. We still don't have the opportunity to buy health insurance across state lines. We still don't have a transportation and infrastructure spending bill that will modernize our ports and our bridges and our roads and our infrastructure and our bus terminals so that we can compete in the global economy. So, look, there's real work to get done. And instead, we're wasting our time in the U.S. Senate with this impeachment, which everybody knows is not going anywhere. So this is political fodder, is all this is. This is Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler wanting to continue to be in front of the media. And John, you know this. They had all the time they wanted in the House to conduct this impeachment hearing. They had all the opportunity they wanted to call witnesses. They rushed through this. Then they held the articles of impeachment for more than 30 days. And now they're saying, when it's over in the Senate, we need to bring more witnesses in. They're saying that because they know they failed and they haven't made their case, and the American people know they failed.
Well, Corey, they went around for 3 weeks here saying they had overwhelming evidence. Then they get to the Senate, and then they say, well, we don't have enough evidence. We need more evidence, so that's why we need more witnesses. How does that work?
Well, look, you know, Pat Cipollone was amazing about this yesterday. He said if he were to go into any courtroom in America and tell a judge that they have overwhelming evidence to present the case, but they can't present it because they need more evidence, they would be thrown out of that courthouse. And that's exactly what it is really about. You know, this is the same guy, Adam Schiff, who made up a conversation that he said Donald Trump had, which we know he never did. He had to apologize for that after. This is the same guy that during the Russia hoax impeachment, the Russia hoax narrative, said there's overwhelming evidence that Donald Trump is basically an agent of Russia. You know, it's amazing. There's no accountability for people like Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler just to continue to lie to the media. The media allows them an opportunity to get on TV, to get on the radio, you know, perpetuate these lies. And then, you know, when they're caught lying red-handed, they say, hey, don't worry about it. So, look, this is going to actually help Donald Trump and Mike Pence get reelected. As I travel the country, and I do it a lot, I'm out in middle America all the time. There is nobody who's actually paying attention to this because it's so convoluted. There is no underlying crime. And so they look at the economy. They look at what this president's done for our military when it comes to rebuilding our military, when it comes to renegotiating bad trade deals, when it comes to supporting the African-American community, which the Democrats have taken advantage of for the last 30 years. They see what this president is doing, and that's why in November, in about 9 months, he's going to win by a larger electoral margin than he did in 2016.
Yeah, because, look, I think we're going to win every state we won. I know that a lot of people talking about Michigan is going the other way. I mean, I think we have a 50-50 chance of winning that, but I think he's going to win New Hampshire. I think he's going to win Minnesota. I think he's got a shot in Nevada. These are states that went the other way this time. I think you win them all.
Well, that's right, John. And you have to remember, right, the Democrats have to find a strategy where they can go back and win in places that Hillary Clinton lost. And there's nowhere on the map. If right. Bernie Sanders is the nominee, I don't see any scenario where he starts picking up seats that is states that Hillary Clinton lost. There's nowhere there. He's an avowed socialist. He literally honeymooned in Russia. And, you know, he believes that giving illegal aliens free health care and free college tuition is what America wants. That's not the case. So they have a very weak field. Today's latest public opinion poll released by CNN shows that Bernie Sanders is the clear front runner right now going into Iowa. If he wins in Iowa and he wins in New Hampshire, in the beginning of February. This race is all but over, and you're looking at a McGovern scenario all over again. You're looking at a Reagan 84 where it's just a complete devastation, because the work that the campaign has done, whether it's building coalitions, whether it's raising money, whether it's professionalizing the operation, I have the opportunity as a senior advisor to talk to the campaign every day and see what they're doing, and it impresses the hell out of me how strong of an operation the Trump campaign has right now.
You're on the John Truckers Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. I am with Corey Lewandowski, senior advisor, Trump-Pence 2020, part of the Mike Pence Hard Money Political Action Committee, as well, senior advisor to that as well. Not a candidate for U.S. Senate, and could have a future somewhere in a second Trump administration. But look, Corey, let's get to politics here. I have been predicting Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee since this thing started. Now he's getting the traction. But let me ask a couple questions. And let me start by saying that I'm going to be in Iowa starting on Thursday morning. I guess that's the 30th for the Trump rally in Des Moines. So we're going to be doing that. We have a campaign radio bus going out. Then we're going to be following these campaigns around. We'll be there through Tuesday. Same thing we did, remember, back in 2016 when we followed the Trump campaign. So we're going to be live there. I think he's going to win Iowa. I think he's going to win New Hampshire. I think he's going to win Nevada. I don't know how you stop him. But let me ask you this. Very interesting. Hillary Clinton yesterday coming out and bashing Sanders in an interview 15 days before the New Hampshire, the Iowa caucuses, that met with a lot of hand-wringing amongst Democrats. Why did she do that? And is there a scenario for a Hillary re-entry?
You know, John, it's amazing. She just can't go away. You know, they say, don't go away angry, just go away. She refuses to go away. It's amazing. She has to try and stay relevant. She's here bashing Bernie Sanders, saying nobody likes the guy. He doesn't have any friends in the U.S. Senate. I actually think that's a badge of honor when you say that, because people hate Washington, D.C. And so, look, if everybody hates Bernie Sanders, maybe there's a reason to take a look at him, because Hillary Clinton, you know, ran the worst campaign in modern presidential history. She had every resources available to her. She had all the money. She had all the people. She had all the support of the Obamas. She had everything. And she lost in such a massive fashion that she has to go and think, hey, maybe, just maybe, if Bernie Sanders can't pull this off and Joe Biden implodes, maybe they'll turn to me and ask me to come back. It is a complete pipe dream. Hillary Clinton is never going to be the president of the United States. She can't beat Donald Trump. We saw what happened when Donald Trump debated her last time. He absolutely destroyed her. You know, remember, John, we were widely criticized in the media because Hillary Clinton was spending a week doing debate prep and Donald Trump was doing 6 and 7 events a day. And I said, he's not going to be prepared. And Hillary Clinton built an exact replica of the debate stage. Who cares? She had no message, and she still has no message. And she's an angry woman because she thinks for some reason she lost in Florida and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Iowa. And she thinks it was all stolen. It wasn't stolen. She had no message. Donald Trump was a better candidate. We ran a better campaign. And there is no path for her to come back and be successful. But she wants to go after Bernie Sanders because she figures if she can do that, maybe, just maybe, she will be the saving grace at the Democrat convention. And boy, if I've got one ask of God, please make her the Democratic nominee. Just please. You know, and then look, I say that jokingly because, right, you know, but look, we would love to see her as the Democratic nominee. The playbook that we ran in 2016 would be dusted off, taken back out, and supersized for the campaign structure that we have in place right now.
We're with Corey Lewandowski. Corey, so let's get to some of these other candidates. But I want to start with this trial because I don't ever really look at any kind of conspiracies, but I never understood why Pelosi held up the articles of impeachment for 25 days. And, you know, it's taken Bernie Sanders off the trail. Like, and it affects us because we're going to Iowa in the bus. Specifically, we got permission from them to follow them around. They don't care. You know, their campaign people are irreverent, just like we were. They're like, sure, if you can get him on your show, he'll talk to anybody, no problem. But now we can't campaign in Iowa, but one day a week. which really opens this thing up for Biden, who was like, you know, weekend at Bernie's. They're propping the guy up. I mean, is there any way that Pelosi held the articles of impeachment so that she could tie Bernie up for the last 2 weeks going into the caucuses?
Well, John, it's quite possible because there was no rational reason for her to hold those articles for almost a month. And now the members of the U.S. Senate are sitting there with no electronic devices. They can have a glass of water or a glass of milk, I guess, on their desk is all they're allowed to have. And they can't go anywhere. And so, look, we've seen the senior advisors and the campaign managers to Barack Obama saying that Bernie Sanders would be a terrible nominee. That is a coordinated effort by the Democrats who don't want to see him. And the truth is, Bernie probably should have been the nominee 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But because of the superdelegates, they stole it from him. And
right.
They're so concerned that this is a guy who actually has a big following. He
yep.
has grassroots support. He gets people to come out, and he has a populist message. Look, he's crazy as a hoot owl, right? And he's a self-avowed socialist. But people actually listen to what he has to say, unlike Hillary Clinton, unlike Joe Biden, who is just so boring, so vanilla that he attracts nobody. So the Democrat elites do not want to see Bernie Sanders. And this may have been a ploy by Nancy Pelosi to force the Democrats to stay in session, if you're a U.S. senator, right up through Iowa so that he can't be out campaigning.
I know. That's the thing. He just stuck there. So is Warren and so is Klobuchar. So that really hurts them because, as you know, Iowa to win that, traditionally you have to have a ground game. All right, let's get to Mayor Bloomberg. We've got he's spending, I don't know, $1 billion running ads, no ground game. He's not in play in Iowa or New Hampshire. What's Bloomberg's strategy here, Corey?
Look, it's very simple. He wants to buy the election. He's pledged $1 billion. I think he'll spend $2 billion. This is a guy who's worth $50 billion. So, you know, think about the equivalent. If you had $50 in your bank account, would you spend $2 of those dollars to potentially be the president? I think you would, and I think he's willing to do that. He's got 1,000 people on the ground. He's bypassed all of the early states, and he's really putting his hopes and dreams on the Super Tuesday days, and so the Super Tuesday states. Now, that being said, you know, he has no message. He has the same problem. He's got a lot of money, but he has no message. He's an anti-Second Amendment, big government liberal who, when he was the mayor of New York, remind you, would not let people buy Big Gulps anymore, right? Too much sugar drinks. And look, it's just, that's not what America is. And now, as you saw this week on the campaign trail, he was out saying that he was benefited by white privilege. Well, yeah, I guess Michael Bloomberg is an old white guy. And so he benefited from that, I guess. And look, the issue that we have with Michael Bloomberg is he doesn't resonate in middle America. He thinks that buying his way to the presidency is a good use of his resources. And honestly, John, I hope he spends it all. He's got a lot of it to spend. Maybe he'll spend it all because he's not going to win. He's polling right now at 5% in the early polls. And so when you don't play in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, or Nevada, it's very difficult to try and make up for the losses that you have there because you're not getting any delegates. And at the end of the day, in order to get elected president, to get the nomination, you have to get delegates. And that's why those early states are so critical, because it gives you momentum, which helps your fundraising, which also shows that the media that you're a winner. And so by him bypassing these early states, it's only going to hurt him long term. Now, he said he's going to stay in all the way through November, whether he's a nominee or not. And look, maybe Michael's playing for the number two spot, but he's going to spend a lot of money right now. I just don't see him moving any numbers.
Yeah, but I think what you just said, he might be playing for the number two spot. But in order for him to get that, look, they're not going to run two old white males, okay? They just can't do it. It's all about identity for the Democrats. There's no scenario where they do that. So he's got to hope that the nominee is Klobuchar, perhaps, or Warren, maybe, something of that scenario. Or what about this talk about Michelle Obama parachuting in at the end?
Oh, look, I know I asked God for one favor earlier in the show, which is to make Hillary Clinton the nominee. Maybe I should ask for a second favor, which is let's have Michelle Obama. Look, she has never been scrutinized in anything. There's just no scenario whatsoever where Michelle Obama is going to try and get in this race and potentially lose the legacy of the Obamas because she has the same problem. She doesn't have any financial resources to put in. Now, look, the Obamas have gotten very rich after they left the White House, but they're not Michael Bloomberg rich. They're probably worth $50 or $100 million, which is an enormous amount of wealth, but they can't put in $1 billion into the race. And, you know, Michelle Obama does not get a free pass if she were to get into the race. And I don't think that they, meaning the Obamas, would want to go through the scrutiny of what that really looks like. And so I don't think Michelle Obama gets in the race. I think Michael Bloomberg is hoping for Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg to be the nominee. He can run as a number two with them. I don't think Amy Klobuchar has any chance of being the nominee, although, you know, the New York Times endorsed two people, which I don't know how you do, but, you know, that's what they did. So, you know, Bloomberg is a guy who is scary because he has unlimited resources, but when you start to see what he really stands for, there's no chance he can actually be a nominee.
I don't think he'd be the nominee either. All right, Corey, final question on logistics. Here's the nightmare scenario for the Dems. Bernie Sanders goes to Milwaukee with a lead, but he can't win on the first ballot. A lot of people don't realize that the way they changed the rules in the Democratic Party nominating process nationally is they got rid of the superdelegates, right, which was the right thing to do. It was rigged. But the superdelegates, Corey, reemerge on a second ballot. So if there's no first ballot victor, it goes back to the adults in the room, so to speak. So let's say you're a caucus goer. You're a delegate from Nevada, Reno, right? You've worked your tail off. You've spent the money. You've driven to Milwaukee 12 hours. You know, you're staying in a Motel 6 or whatever. You get there. Your first vote is worth one vote. Your second vote is worth a half a vote because the superdelegates took the other half. And then Bernie gets beat. I mean, is that crazy or what?
No, look, this is a completely rigged system, right? It's a completely rigged system. Don't forget, when Donald Trump was running and we were at the convention, there was a move by some states to try and get Ted Cruz to beat Donald Trump, even though we had the requisite number of delegates. There was a move by certain members of the Cruz campaign to try and beat Donald Trump on the floor. Now, we beat that back, and obviously I think everybody in America is very happy that Donald Trump is the president of the United States when they look at their bank accounts. But on the Democrat side, they're so afraid of Bernie Sanders being their nominee that they want what I call Operation Chaos, which is they can't get anybody confirmed on the first ballot, and then what they're doing is they're going to go to the, quote, adults in the room, and then they will steal this from Bernie again. They'll steal it from him again, and they'll give it to someone who, in their estimation, can beat Donald Trump. But the truth is, there is no candidate on the Democratic side right now who can beat Donald Trump. It doesn't exist, and I look forward to that challenge. But that will severely divide the Democrats once they steal this from Bernie Sanders for the second time.
All right, Corey Lewandowski, we're out of time. Are you going to the Trump rally in Des Moines, Iowa at the end of the month?
I will be in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm part of the surrogate operation for the campaign. We'll be heading out there and making sure that we're doing media out there, both for the rally and for the caucuses out there.
So I'll be out there as well. We'll get together, no question, and then I'll be in New Hampshire, as I've told you, staying right there by your home for 5 days. So I think a week I'm in New Hampshire. So we'll get together there as well. Corey Lewandowski, thank you, man. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for the insight. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to the John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. Online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com. 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. NBA legend Kobe Bryant, his 13-year-old daughter, are confirmed dead after their helicopter went down in Southern California. According to the sheriff, records show nine people were aboard Bryant's helicopter, all died. The chopper crashed Sunday in Calabasas, about 30 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles. Bryant was an all-time basketball great who won five NBA titles with the Los Angeles Lakers. China says that the death toll from a new virus has now risen to 80 with 2,744 confirmed cases. The National Health Commission said Monday morning that there were 769 new cases confirmed in the 24 hours through midnight Sunday. China has also extended the Lunar New Year holiday by 3 days to next Sunday in an effort to contain the spread of the virus. More details at srnnews.com.
Guys, waking up over and over to urinate is not okay. But now, you can reduce those nighttime bathroom trips with the ingredients in Super Beta Prostate P3 Advanced. We're talking about less urges to urinate at night, less bathroom trips during the day, and better bladder emptying.
It's like taking three prostate supplements in one.
You can try a full 30-day bottle of P3 Advanced, free. Just pay shipping and handling. No strings attached, no obligations, and no commitments to buy. This is a 30-day supply, absolutely free. Call 1-800-458-4221. Super Beta Prostate is the best-selling brand in major retailers like Walmart. But for this no-strings-attached free bottle, you must call now. 1-800-458-4221. Don't miss out on this unprecedented free offer. Call 1-800-458-4221. 1-800-458-4221.
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling 3 jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone who
had to be independent and take initiative, and that's how I handle every project I get.
Discover new ways to develop great talent at gradsoflife.org, brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
If you don't have a battery-operated radio and light when the power goes out, you may be considered a little crazy. This is Bob from Sea Crane, and radio is the only service that stays up when all communications are down. We believe that having an emergency radio and light that always works is one of the most important things you can have in your emergency kit. Well, with the CC Observer, you get both. The Observer is an AM, FM, and weather band radio that will keep you updated during any local emergency. The Observer can be charged by a hand crank or can be used with common AA batteries. It has a built-in flashlight and a lighted dial. The CC Observer is the radio and light source that you should have during a power outage.
To order the new CC Observer, now with the solar panel, please give us a call at 800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863. Or visit us online at ccradio.com. Sea Crane, the high-performance radio and light company.
Join me, Dr. G, on the next America First, where I'll recap the first day of the Senate trial of President Donald Trump with Congressman Steve Scalise and the newest member of the Trump campaign, Boris Epstein. Then talk to the Secretary of the Interior, David Bernhardt, live from the SHOT Show in Vegas, and John Lott on the latest attempts from the left to take away your God-given Second Amendment rights to protect yourself and our republic from tyranny.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekdays 3 till 5 on WBOB.
The John Frederick Show.
Joining us now is Sean Connaughton. He's the president and CEO of the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association and a fellow passenger with me on the 2020 Trump train. Now, he's going to give us right now the skinny on what's happening with healthcare. At the General Assembly, we're going to talk to you about some new statewide poll numbers VHHA released this week. And also we're going to talk about the fact that we now believe, as the president said, he can win Virginia. I think Trump has an outside shot to carry Virginia. We're certainly going to do our part to see that done. Sean Connaughton, welcome back, sir.
Hey, good. Well, Happy New Year, John. I think it's the first time I've been on this year, so it's great to be back again with you.
Okay, before we get to business, how's your lovely wife?
My wife is fantastic. She's up there in beautiful Northern Virginia right now. But yeah, no, we're doing good. Kids doing good. My son's over in Afghanistan right now, so we're just waiting for him to come home. So that's sort of our big. That'll be our Christmas gift late.
Well, you know, we've been fighting hard to get all our kids out of there. Hopefully, we can do that sooner rather than later, and hope your son stays safe and gets home quickly. And we appreciate his service to the country, Sean. I mean, it's tough as a father having one of your kids over there, not knowing day to day what happens. So I know it's stressful. So hopefully he'll come home. He'll come home soon, Sean. You know, several of the things that you mentioned that we talked about earlier offline a little bit. I mean, there's so much happening in the Capitol in Rich Vegas these days. The Democrats are working overtime to restrict our Second Amendment rights, upend years of culture and tradition in Virginia, and they want to pass all these new laws. While people have a lot of feelings on this, Sean, let's not lose sight of the fact that there's other important issues being decided in the state assembly, including some big health care issues. This is why I wanted you on today, because, you know, they're kind of falling by the wayside. We're talking about gun grabbing and all this other stuff, right to work. Nobody's talking about the health care issues, right? So give us an update, Sean, if you would, on some of the big health care bills that you're watching in the 2020 General Assembly.
Yeah, and John, your point is right on. I mean, if you look at any of the polls, and if you, you know, just from your social circles, talk to people, health care remains one of the biggest issues, biggest concerns for everyday voters. And, you know, the General Assembly is dealing with a lot of issues that are maybe new to Richmond, or the fights about them are newer to Richmond, but they are still working on a lot of very, very important health care bills, things like certificate of public need, looking at balanced billing, looking at some of the practices of the insurance companies, working to deal with the trauma center. One of the things that ended up happening last year, that when the governor did go and erase all the fees for, you know, penalties for DMV, for reckless driving and things like that, it actually took away the money for trauma centers throughout the state. And so we're working this year to make sure we get our money back so that we can continue to serve the people of Virginia in any sort of, whenever there's any sort of accidents or natural man-made disasters. But, you know, this work is continuing. I mean, we're there working with a lot of our healthcare and hospital stakeholders, as well as others out in the community, to make sure that we can continue to deliver good healthcare, quality healthcare to the people of Virginia, and find a way to reduce the costs that involve, particularly in what we're seeing that's happening in the insurance industry and what is ever-increasing costs of health insurance that do not at all match the costs of what is happening in healthcare. So if our poll that we just did, you just mentioned, I mean, it goes out to show you some of the, you know, where people stand in the state. We piggybacked onto a Mason-Dixon poll, and Mason-Dixon came back a very credible poll, so people can't question the numbers. But, you know, things like balance billing, surprise billing, that's where sometimes people end up going to an emergency room. They have to bring in somebody who might not be in the insurance network of the insurance being held by the person who's had an accident. Patients should not have to deal with that.
Exactly.
This should be a fight. This should be a fight between the provider and the insurance companies. But you think about this. You and I and people across the state are spending thousands of dollars a month for insurance plans. You go to an ER, and all of a sudden, because one doctor may end up not being in that insurance company's network, the insurance company might not pay and tell you, the patient, that it's your responsibility. And that's ridiculous. And that's one of the things why we've been pushing for bipartisan legislation. In fact, last year passed 40-0 in the Senate and actually got through the major committees in the House, but ended up dying in the last bit of the General Assembly last year. We're pushing that legislation again that will take patients out of the surprise billing conundrum and end up making it essentially a negotiation between the provider and the insurance company, which is where it should be to begin with. And you know what? Overwhelmingly, people in this poll, I mean, overwhelmingly end up saying that we should end up with a proposal or legislation that's closer to what we are pushing in the healthcare industry versus what the insurance companies are pushing.
Well, you know, Sean, I'm glad you brought that up, the surprise billing issue, because I've been covering that nationally now for about 6 months. By the way, we're with Sean Cannot. He's the president and the chief executive officer of the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association, acronym VHAA. Sean, the surprise billing thing is real to a lot of people. And you know, with impeachment and guns, I mean, it gets just pushed aside. But there are so many listeners that we have, including me, who, you know, got home one day and I got a bill in the mail for $7,900. I had a colonoscopy with a few polyps or something. You know, I get a bill for almost $8,000. I have no idea what it is from the hospital. No clue. Yeah. Go to my insurance company. Well, they went to an out of provider or something. I had no knowledge of that. And, you know, if you don't pay it, what happens? You know, they get a judgment, hurts your credit. I mean, the thing is a nightmare. And, like, how do you get a bill that you had no idea that you were even a party to that? So I agree with you. I mean, surprise billing is a big issue, both federally and in the state. And, you know, hopefully we can get something done on that so this nonsense stops. I've got a couple other things I want to get to, but I just want to take an aside here for a second. Both of us were proponents of Medicaid expansion in Virginia. Certainly I was. I got a lot of heat for that, but I thought it was the right thing to do because this is for working class Virginians that are working two and three jobs and we're falling in the cracks between Obamacare subsidies, Medicaid. They made too much money, but they didn't have enough money to buy insurance. You were a proponent of that. You know, 6 months in now, is that meeting some of the expectations that the hospital association had?
Yeah, and John, listen, and we appreciate very much your support for that, as well as Virginians across the state. In fact, we saw a groundswell of support among Republicans and Democrats for Medicaid expansion because it's ended up providing health care to, I think now the numbers are almost 350,000 people. And these are people, these are our friends, these are people who can't afford necessarily to be able to purchase commercial insurance or don't have employers who can provide that insurance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are just seeing a dramatic increase in the number of people coming in, being provided service. And we are actually starting to see some of these health outcomes already starting to have a positive effect on the state. And so we think it's been a great success. Unfortunately, up in Washington right now, there's things like Medicare for All that really we are very concerned with. I mean, right now, I think in Virginia, like 93% of the people have insurance, whether through their employer, through commercial insurance, through Medicaid, Medicare. You know, let's focus on that 7%
exactly
that don't have coverage. Don't blow up our insurance or that our healthcare system.
Crazy.
For the 93% who right now have coverage and actually are able to get healthcare.
Sean, is that 93% number, Virginians that have healthcare, is that one of the highest in America?
It's pretty high up there, and there are actually some other states that are a little bit higher. I mean, so we are constantly looking for ways to provide coverage. But the great thing, as everyone knows, that, you know, Virginia's hospitals and health systems provide care, emergency care, to people regardless of their ability to pay. And, you know, they're there in case people really need urgent care. But obviously it's the preventative care that's important to get to make sure that people are, you know, don't get those sort of chronic conditions, don't end up having what could be start out as a minor issue turn into a major issue. And that is where things like Medicaid expansion and some of the other programs that we're pursuing end up actually providing that type of care.
Wow. Well, you know, we fought the good fight. I still defend Medicaid expansion. And I just want to point out to our listeners, too, those 350,000, 85% of those are Trump voters that voted for the president because they believed that this president would help fix the system, and they're working people. So just want to keep reminding everybody of that that gets upset over it. Sean Cannot with us, president and CEO of the VHHA, Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association. Several of the things you mentioned, balanced billing, certificate of public need, are also issues I've discussed for years, and my position is clear. Look, you can't have a healthcare system where the government requires hospitals to provide free care to the poor, what we call indigent care, uninsured people, without safeguards in place to ensure that all providers are invested in charity care. And what drives me berserk about certificate of public need and those of my conservative brethren that want to die on this hill about free market competition and we should get rid of COPN. If somebody wants to open up a medical facility, they should be allowed to do that. It's unfair competition because the hospital, I can't seem to get conservatives to get this. If you have a hospital, that hospital has to have an emergency room. That emergency room has to take anybody who comes in at any time under any circumstance by law. You know who signed it, Sean? Ronald Reagan. He signed that into law. They can't turn anybody away, whether they can pay insurance, no insurance, whatever it is, they have to take them. They have to care for them. That is millions and millions of dollars for a hospital in some areas. So what happens is if you get rid of certificate for public need, guess what happens? Medical corporations. These are not mom and pop, it's some doctor. These are corporations who come in to the area. They don't offer emergency room service. They don't offer all the things a hospital does. They only offer the most high-margin, profitable things, like an MRI and things like that. So they cherry-pick. They underprice the hospital. The hospital needs that in order to pay for everything else that the government mandates they have to have. So there's no competition. I cannot get people to understand this. And every time COPN has been taken out of a state, guess what happens? Rural hospitals, it's happened in Georgia, it's happened in South Carolina. Guess what happens to them, Sean? They go out of business. I mean, this is plain as a nose on your face. Why can't I get conservatives to grasp this concept?
You know, John, I mean, and
am I right?
No, you're exactly right. In fact, I couldn't say it better. I mean, what makes healthcare so difficult is for people maybe to get their arms around it is that, there isn't a free market in healthcare. I mean, because hospitals and the health systems that are around the hospitals, like you said, they take all comers. And in fact, if you look at the payer mix, what we call the payer mix, two-thirds of the patients in our hospitals today are Medicare, Medicaid, or, essentially free care, charity care. Now, if you look out in Virginia right now, about two-thirds of the people in the state have commercial insurance. And so right now, we are seeing, especially we think about it, older people, Medicare, Medicaid, are those with lower incomes, then those with essentially no incomes get charity care. I mean, these are people that right now are using the system. And what they're trying to do, I mean, this is what the proponents are trying to do, is take that one-third of our patients who are commercial patients and take them out of the health system because we have to take these other patients. And the challenge we have is, we won't be in existence. Right now across the state, and we know we have the numbers, we can show that in the majority of communities in this state, one of the largest employers is the hospital and health system. And if you take that away, you will see, right now we have serious challenges in rural Virginia and in some of our urban centers. You take away that hospital, not only will you take away a major job generator that brings in very high-end, very high-skilled jobs, you will never see economic development in those communities. You will never see it. Mm-hmm. No one is going to move a major facility, a plant or warehouse, anything, to a community that doesn't have a hospital. And so in some ways, this argument that here we are spending billions of dollars to attract companies like Amazon, yet at the same time, some people are working to undermine the very communities that put the money in.
It's crazy.
To essentially attract Amazon, which is just ludicrous.
Makes sense.
We have to find ways to buttress our health system, mm-hmm. particularly in, and I'm going to say this again, rural areas.
Right.
We are seeing, obviously, a much higher proportion of people who are elderly who are on Medicare and on these other programs. So let's find ways to strengthen the system, stop by trying to fight for ways to undermine it.
We're with Sean Connaughton. He's president and CEO of the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association, giving us an update on healthcare in Virginia, what's going on in the General Assembly. Sean, you mentioned rising insurance rates. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, John, I mean, we don't understand what is happening. I mean, we can show numbers that, you know, essentially the price increases for hospitals and health systems is going up about 2% a year, just around inflation. Yet insurance premiums are going up double digits. I mean, and you step back and you look at what the plans they're selling. In fact, one of the questions we asked on the poll that we just did, and it mirrored, which is just to validate the answers in the poll, right now it's estimated 40% of the people in this country have these high deductible plans, plans that require you to spend $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000 out of your pocket before the insurance company, who you're paying thousands of dollars to a month, will even pay one claim. And so when we asked this question, it nationally it's about 40%. Our poll came back at 39% of the respondents said they had a high deductible plan. And then when you go and ask them the next question, have you deferred any health care because of this high deductible? And something like 40-something percent said yes. And so where is this money going? You're spending all this money. You're seeing premiums going up. You're getting these narrow networks. You know, one of the reasons we're starting to see a rise in, you know, this balanced billing is because they are narrowing it and more narrowing the doctors that you can go see.
Right.
And where is the money going? I mean, we just step back, and we are hoping that with the state this year now looking at potentially creating a state-based insurance exchange, that they can start to ask some of these questions regarding this high cost of insurance and what is happening, why we're seeing this complete divergence between how much we're paying the out-of-state insurance companies and how much we're really seeing the costs increase for actually the provision of health care. And what I can tell you on behalf of my members, every time we figure out a way to lower our costs, we don't see any commensurate decrease in your premiums. So where's the money going?
No one knows. I mean,
yeah,
that's the thing. No one knows where the money's going. And
John, right now, you can go on a website in for California. I can't believe that I'm sitting there pointing to something in California, but I'm telling you right now, in California, they have a website that you can go in there and see exactly how much every insurance company is making on every service line. It's all there. You can look at it. And here in Virginia, it goes into that, you know, into the State Corporation Commission behind closed doors. We have no idea what is happening and where the money's going.
Right. Well, or what the insurance markup is or who they're paying. I mean, the non-transparency of this system is really what is driving people nuts. And you look at this Mason-Dixon poll, and I'm running out of time, Sean, but I mean, some of these numbers are stunning. 53% of Virginians say certificate of public need should be maintained. Only 14% want it out. That's 4-1. You look at the other thing, you know, 2/3 of Virginians express support for the current health care delivery system with COPN in place. A vast majority of Virginians want something to be done with balanced billing. They want surprise billing, and they want transparency. And that's what you just said. We ought to be able to go on any site and see, this is insurance. It's, you know, people have to have, what is the cost? What are they making? What are they charging? What are they paying? Because it's all over the board.
And, John, you could do that for hospitals right now. You can do that right now. We have, the state has a thing called Virginia Health Information Office. You could see that for hospitals. You can't see that for the insurance companies. Why not?
Because I had a question here from Amy in Fairfax. She said, could you ask Sean Connaughton if hospitals publicly post their prices?
Yes, we do right now.
Yes.
In fact, you can go on. We have a thing called Price Point. You can go on to our website, www.vhha.com, and you can actually see ours. And actually, we have various requirements for hospitals, again, just hospitals, to go out there and publish our rates. And we're trying to get better with it. You know, the challenge is it's, you know, and this is, again, one of the big challenges is what we charge is not what necessarily you, with your insurance plan, will actually pay. Mm-hmm. And each plan is different. Each negotiation is different. But we do charge and put up our charges on our website here for our members, and actually you can do it for each individual hospital as well.
All right, and then final thing I have to say, I got a text here from one of your fans, Ben Knotts, who's the legislative assistant, the legislative director for Americans for Prosperity. Sean, I got to read you this funny text by Ben. He says, legislative liaison for Americans for Prosperity. He says, Sean, fake polls.
I don't think Mason Dixon. And you know what? Unlike fake polls, we actually sent out the questions and the answers and the breakdown. So if he would like to go and take a look at it, in fact, you know, I can send it to him personally if you'd like. I mean, because it is, again, it's all about transparency. And that's what we're about. And we're going to try to work together, and we're going to work with you, John, and all your listeners to make healthcare better and more cost-effective in this state.
Hey, final question. We're also a proponent of telemedicine, like doctors being able to prescribe and counsel over an iPhone and getting nurse practitioners to be able to do that, going across state lines. Have you guys fleshed out any position on telemedicine at all?
Yeah, no, John, we're very supportive of it. We think it's great. We try to support it, and actually many of our systems have telemedicine already in place. It's been a challenge for a couple reasons. One thing is it's about reimbursement for getting paid, whether for the government or for the commercial insurers to actually provide that service. Another big issue has been licensing you know, across state lines or whichever, and then who's actually providing the care. So these are things that we're working to address. Believe it or not, there is an actual telemedicine center out in UVA, which is one of our members, and they're working to improve what we have today to make it even better out into the future.
All right, Sean Kinnaughton, we're out of time. I really want to thank you for that great update.
Hey, John, wait, one thing, John.
Go ahead.
One thing. I got to give a shout-out to Ernie, our UPS man. He is a big fan. He ended up pointing out to me that he is a big fan. He said all the UPS drivers here in Richmond are big fans of John Frederick. So going to give him a big shout-out.
Ernie, baby, go. John Frederick Show, Godzilla of Truth for UPS, Ernie. You're the man. Thank you. Spread the word. I really appreciate it. Sean Kinnaughton, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association. And by the way, these are not fake polls. This is Mason Dixon. And if you really understand the markets, COPN is the best thing we have, because otherwise rural hospitals go out of business because it's cherry picking. John Frederick's Radio Network.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. On great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at